So the theme of this section is application of mindfulness, and sort of the sub-theme is around modulation and fine-tuning, so that how to use our mindfulness to fine-tune both the energy and concentration, wisdom aspects. So this is picking up the theme of mindfulness directed to the body. Even as one who encompasses with his mind the mighty ocean includes thereby all the rivulets that run into the ocean, just so, O monks, whoever develops and cultivates mindfulness directed to the body includes thereby all the wholesome states that partake of supreme knowledge. One thing, O monks, if developed and cultivated, leads to a strong sense of urgency, to great benefit, to great security from bondage, to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to the attainment of vision and knowledge, to a pleasant dwelling in this very life, to the realization of the fruit of knowledge and liberation. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness directed to the body. If one thing, O monks, is developed and cultivated, the body is calmed, the mind is calmed, discursive thoughts are quietened, and all wholesome states that partake of supreme knowledge reach fullness of development. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness directed to the body. If one thing, O monks, is developed and cultivated, ignorance is abandoned, supreme knowledge arises, delusion of self is given up, the underlying tendencies are eliminated, and the fetters are discarded. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness directed to the body. They do not partake of the deathless who do not partake of mindfulness directed to the body. They partake of the deathless who partake of mindfulness directed to the body. The deathless is lost to those who have lost mindfulness directed to the body. Not lost is the deathless to those who have not lost mindfulness directed to the body. They will fail to reach the deathless who fail in mindfulness directed to the body. They gain the deathless who gain mindfulness directed to the body. They neglect the quest for the deathless who neglect mindfulness directed to the body. They do not neglect the quest for the deathless who do not neglect mindfulness directed to the body. They forget the deathless who forget mindfulness directed to the body. They do not forget the deathless who do not forget mindfulness directed to the body. They are undeveloped in the quest for the deathless who are undeveloped in mindfulness directed to the body. They are developed in the quest for the deathless who are developed in mindfulness directed to the body. They have not comprehended the deathless who have not comprehended mindfulness directed to the body. They have comprehended the deathless who have comprehended mindfulness directed to the body. They have not realized the deathless who have not realized mindfulness directed to the body. They have realized the deathless who have realized mindfulness directed to the body. Pretty emphatic encouragement to be attending to mindfulness of the body. The next reading is from the Anguttara 8, Sutta number 81, on Hiri and Otapa. Bhikkhus, when mindfulness and clear comprehension are present, conscience, Hiri, and integrity, Otapa, are the causal result. When conscience and integrity are present, sense restraint is the causal result. When sense restraint is present, virtue is the causal result. When virtue is present, true concentration, samadhi, is the causal result. When true concentration is present, knowledge and vision of how it really is the causal result. When such knowledge and vision is present, disinterest and dispassion are the causal result. When disinterest and dispassion are present, the knowledge and vision of liberation is the causal result. Because it is just as in the case of a tree, possessing branches and foliage, the shoots come to maturity, likewise the bark, likewise the sapwood and the core. In just this way, when mindfulness and clear comprehension are present, and then through that whole list again, knowledge and vision of liberation are the causal result. That Hiri and Otapa are difficult words to translate. I looked up a few. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing. And Ajahn Jeff translates it as conscience and concern. And Morris Walsh translates it as moral shame and moral dread. With all those various translations, it's still hard to get a feel for how positive and wholesome, or it's hard to emphasize how important it is. So Ajahn Chah would put a lot of emphasis on the presence of Hiri Otapa as a wholesome foundation for all the practice.
Ajahn, you didn't mention who gave the translation of conscious and integrity.
Conscience and integrity. It was what was in the notes, and I'm not quite sure. There's no. These are the notes that Ajahn Sujito was using, so I don't know whether he made that up himself or he found it somewhere else. So.
Kaya.
Kaya means body, like kaya, like the kayakata sati is mindfulness of the body, whereas rupa is like just form in general. Could be referring to the body, like when we do the chanting in the morning, we say the rupang nichang, and we translate it as the body is impermanent. I say probably more correctly, its form is impermanent. It's more general. Gaya is more specific to the body. Okay, the next sutta is from the Anguttara 4, sutta number 37.
Endowed with four qualities, a monk is incapable of falling away and is right in the presence of Nibbana. Which four? There is the case where a monk is consummate in virtue, guards the doors to his sense faculties, knows moderation in eating, and is devoted to wakefulness. And how is a monk consummate in virtue? There is the case where a monk is virtuous. He dwells restrained in accordance with the Patimokkha, consummate in his behavior and sphere of activity. He trains himself, having undertaken the training rules, seeing danger in the slightest faults. This is how a monk is consummate in virtue. And how does a monk guard the doors to his sense faculties? There is the case where a monk, on seeing a form with the eye, doesn't grasp at any theme or variations by which, if he were to dwell without restraint over the faculty of the eye, evil unskillful qualities such as greed or distress might assail him. He practices with restraint. He guards the faculty of the eye.
He achieves restraint with regard to the faculty of the eye. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an aroma with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on feeling a tactile sensation with the body, on cognizing an idea with the intellect, he doesn't grasp at any theme or variations by which, if he were to dwell without restraint over the faculty of the intellect, evil, unskillful qualities such as greed or distress might assail him. He practices with restraint. He guards the faculty of the intellect. He achieves restraint with regard to the faculty of the intellect. This is how a monk guards the doors to his sense faculties. And how does a monk know moderation in eating? There is the case where a monk, considering it appropriately, takes his food not playfully, not for intoxication, nor for putting on bulk, nor for beautification, but simply for the survival and continuance of this body, for ending its afflictions, for the support of the celibate life, thinking, I will destroy old feelings of hunger and not create new feelings from overeating. Thus I will maintain myself, be blameless, and live in comfort. This is how a monk knows moderation in eating. And how is a monk devoted to wakefulness? There is the case where a monk, during the day, sitting and pacing back and forth, cleanses his mind of any qualities that would hold the mind in check. During the first watch of the night, he's got a brackets on that, dusk to 10 p.m., sitting and pacing back and forth, he cleanses his mind of any qualities that would hold the mind in check. During the second watch of the night, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., reclining on his right side, he takes up the lion's posture, one foot placed on top of the other, mindful, alert, with his mind set on getting up, either as soon as he awakens or at a particular time. During the last watch of the night, 2 a.m. to dawn, sitting and pacing back and forth, he cleanses his mind of any qualities that would hold the mind in check. This is how a monk is devoted to wakefulness. Endowed with these four qualities, a monk is incapable of falling away and is right in the presence of Nibbana. And then it ends with verses. The monk established in virtue, restrained with regard to the sense faculties, knowing moderation in food and devoted to wakefulness, dwelling thus ardently, day and night, untiring, he develops skillful qualities for the attainment of rest from the yoke. The monk delighting in heedfulness and seeing danger in heedlessness is incapable of falling away, is right in the presence of Nibbana. Okay. The next sutta is from the Sutta Nipata. It's from the chapter 2, sutta number 10. Get up. Sit up. What's your need for sleep? And what sleep is there for the afflicted, pierced by the arrow, oppressed? Get up. Sit up. Train firmly for the sake of peace. Don't let the king of death, seeing you heedless, deceive you, bring you under his sway. Cross over the attachment to which human and heavenly beings remain desiring, tied. Don't let the moment pass by. Those for whom the moment is past grieve, consigned to hell. Heedlessness is dust. Dust comes from heedlessness, has heedlessness on its heels. Through heedfulness and clear knowing, you'd remove your own arrow. Actually, could somebody go over to my office on the desk there, it's underneath the Majjhima Nikaya, to see how Dr. Sadatisa translates that one. Ajahn Jeff translated the title of the sutta as Initiative, and Dr. Sadatisa translates it as Arousing, an urgent exhortation to exert effort. Arise, sit up. What advantage is there in your sleeping? What sleep is there to those who are afflicted by disease, pierced by the arrow of suffering? Arise, sit up. Train yourselves resolutely to attain peace. Do not let the king of evil, Mara, knowing you are negligent, delude you and place you under his control. Overcome this craving to which gods and humans remain attached and seek pleasure. Do not let the opportune moment pass. Those who let the opportune moment pass grieve when they are consigned to woe. Negligence is a taint, and so is the taint which falls continuously from negligence to negligence. By earnestness and knowledge, let one pluck out his dart of passions. The next is a again, sort of around the theme of mindfulness and mindfulness / heedfulness. Venerable Ananda Maitreya translates it as mindfulness. And I think it has actually what is usually translated as heedfulness, pamada. Mindfulness is the path to immortality. Negligence is the path to death. The vigilant never die, whereas the negligent are the living dead. With this understanding, the wise, having developed a high degree of mindfulness, rejoice in mindfulness, delighting in the domain of the noble ones. These awakened ones, dedicated to meditation, striving actively and vigorously, attain Nibbana, the ultimate security. The fame and fortune of the man who is vigorous, aware, unsullied, acting with consideration and restraint, become ever-growing. The wise, by vigor, mindfulness, restraint, and self-control, creates for himself an island which no flood can submerge. The foolish, the unwise, surrender themselves to negligence, whereas the wise man protects mindfulness as his most valuable possession. Don't lose yourself in negligence. Don't lose yourself in sensuality. For it is the mindful and meditative man who will experience supreme happiness. When the enlightened being frees himself from careless behavior through mindfulness, free of sorrow, he gazes on the sorrowing masses as one on the mountaintop gazes on the plain below. The mindful person among the mindless, the aware person among the unaware, surpasses the rest with his wisdom, like a superb racehorse outstripping an old worn-out horse. By mindfulness did the Bhagavat, Lord of Two Realms, it's according to the belief of ancient Indians as a king of a certain heavenly realm, by mindfulness did the Bhagavat, the Lord of Two Realms, reach the position of authority among the gods. So vigilant is ever praised and negligence ever disdained. A seeker concentrating on mindfulness advances like a fire, consuming the chains of bondage, both great and small. A monk or lay person rejoicing in mindfulness, seeing the danger of negligence, cannot fall backwards and is close to Nibbana. Okay. So this next sutta is on various themes of meditation for our fine tuning, and it's actually the it's from Anguttara 9's Sutta number 3, and it's the sutta that Venerable Karunadhammo doctor mentioned in his talk the other day. Meghya. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Chalika, on the Chalika hill. There the Venerable Meghya, who was at that time the Blessed One's attendant, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and said to him while standing at one side, "Lord, I wish to go to Jantugama for alms." "You may do as you think fit, Meghya." Then the Venerable Meghya, dressing himself in the morning and taking robe and bowl, entered Jantugama for alms. Having made the alms round and taken his meal, he went to the bank of the Kimikala River. There, while walking around to stretch his legs, he saw a pleasant and beautiful mango grove. Seeing it, he thought, "Pleasant indeed is this mango grove. It is beautiful. Truly, it is fit for a clansman who wishes to strive in meditation. If the Blessed One allows it, I shall return to this mango grove to strive in meditation." Then the Venerable Meghya approached the Blessed One and said to him, "Lord, after my alms round in Jantugama, when I had taken my meal, I went to the bank of the Kimikala River. While walking there, I saw a pleasant and beautiful mango grove, which I thought to be fit for a clansman who wishes to strive in meditation. If the Blessed One permits me, I shall go there and strive." "Wait a while, Meghya. We are now alone here. First, let another monk come." But the Venerable Meghya repeated his request, saying, "Lord, for the Blessed One, there is nothing further to achieve and no need to consolidate what he has achieved. But as for me, Lord, there is still more to achieve and the need to consolidate what I have achieved. If the Blessed One permits me, I shall go to that mango grove and strive." Again the Blessed One asked him to wait, and again the Venerable Meghya made his request for a third time. Then the Blessed One said, "As you speak of striving, Meghya, what can we say? You may do now as you think fit." The Venerable Meghya then rose from his seat, saluted the Blessed One, and keeping him to his right, left for the mango grove. Having arrived, he went deeper into the grove and sat down under a tree to spend the day there. But while staying in that mango grove, three kinds of evil, unwholesome thoughts constantly assailed him: sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of violence. Then he thought, "Truly, it is strange, it is amazing. I have gone forth from home into the homeless life out of faith, and yet I am harassed by these three kinds of evil, unwholesome thoughts: sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of violence." Then the Venerable Meghya went back to the Blessed One, and having saluted him, he told him what had occurred and exclaimed, "Truly, it is strange, it is amazing. I have gone forth from home into the homeless life out of faith, and yet I am harassed by these three kinds of evil, unwholesome thoughts." If, Meghya, the mind still lacks maturity for liberation, there are five conditions conducive to making it mature. What five? The first thing, Meghya, for making the immature mind mature for liberation, is to have a noble friend, a noble companion, a noble associate. Further, Meghya, a monk should be virtuous, restrained by the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, seeing danger in the slightest faults. Having undertaken the training rules, he should train himself in them. This is the second thing that makes the immature mind mature for liberation. Further, Meghya, the talk in which a monk engages should befit an austere life and be helpful to mental clarity. That is to say, it should be talk on fewness of wishes, on contentment, on solitude, on seclusion, on application of energy, on virtue, concentration, wisdom, liberation, and on the knowledge and vision of liberation. If a monk finds opportunities for such talk easily and without difficulty, this is the third thing that makes the immature mind mature for liberation. Further, Meghya, a monk lives with his energy set upon the abandoning of everything unwholesome and the acquiring of everything wholesome. He is steadfast and strong in his effort, not shirking his task in regard to wholesome qualities. This is the fourth thing that makes the immature mind mature for liberation. Further, Meghya, a monk possesses wisdom. He is equipped with that wisdom which sees into the rise and fall of phenomena, which is noble and penetrative, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. This is the fifth thing that makes the immature mind mature for liberation. When Meghya, a monk, has a noble friend, a noble companion, and associate, it can be expected that he will be virtuous, that he will engage in talk befitting the austere life and helpful to mental clarity, that his energy will be set upon the abandoning of everything unwholesome and the acquiring of everything wholesome, and that he will be equipped with the wisdom that leads to the complete destruction of suffering. Then, Meghya, when the monk is firmly grounded in these five things, he should cultivate four other things. He should cultivate the meditation on the unattractiveness of the body for abandoning lust. He should cultivate loving-kindness for abandoning ill-will. He should cultivate mindfulness of breathing for cutting off distracting thoughts. He should cultivate the perception of impermanence for eliminating the conceit I am. In one who perceives impermanence, the perception of non-self becomes firmly established. And one who perceives non-self achieves the elimination of the conceit I am and attains nibbana in this very life. Okay, the next sutta is around samatha and vipassana. These four kinds of persons, O monks, are found existing in the world. What for? Here, monks, a certain person gains inner tranquility of mind, but does not gain the higher wisdom of insight into things. Another person gains the higher wisdom of insight into things, but does not gain internal tranquility of mind. Another person gains neither internal tranquility of mind nor the higher wisdom of insight into things. And another person gains both internal tranquility of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into things. Therein, monks, the person who gains internal tranquility of mind but not the higher wisdom of insight into things should approach one who gains the higher wisdom and inquire of him. How, friend, should formations be seen? How should formations be explored? How should constructions be discerned with insight? The other then answers him as he has seen and understood the matter thus. Formation should be seen in such a way. They should be explored in such a way. They should be discerned with insight in such a way. At a later time, this one gains both internal tranquility of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into things. Therein, monks, the person who gains the higher wisdom of insight into things but not internal tranquility of mind should approach one who gains internal tranquility and inquire of him. How, friend, should the mind be steadied? How should the mind be composed? How should the mind be unified? How should the mind be concentrated? The other then answers him as he has seen and understood the matter thus. The mind should be steadied in such a way, composed in such a way, unified in such a way, concentrated in such a way. At a later time, this one gains both internal tranquility of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into things. Therein, monks, the person who gains neither internal tranquility of mind nor the higher wisdom of insight into things should approach one who gains both and inquire of him. How, friend, should the mind be steadied? How, friend, should formations be seen? The other then answers him as he has seen and understood the matter thus. The mind should be steadied in such a way, and through the formations and into steadying. The mind should be steadied in such a way, formation should be seen in such a way. At a later time, this one gains both internal tranquility of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into things. Therein, monks, the person who gains both internal tranquility of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into things should establish himself in just these wholesome states and make a further effort for the destruction of the taints. Okay, any questions? I could leave it there.
Tamakatthaya sattukarang dhamma sattva.